Picking off where we left off about neutron stars or TOV solutions, I'll show you a few results regarding critical phenomenon with neutron stars. Then we'll pick up and investigate the relativistic MHD equations that are so important in order to study astrophysical phenomena in space that's highly dense and relativistic. And then that'll also give you some clues as to how to solve your homework assignment. Note that the problem homework number two, it asks to derive the relativistic version of the Navier-Stokes equations. The Navier-Stokes equations include viscosity and heat conduction, but I think Luis wants you to derive the Euler-Lagrange equations, which are just the ideal MHD equations. Excuse me. Principally, I say that because he writes down the stress energy tensor, and it doesn't include any viscosity terms. So it would if it was the Navier-Stokes equation. So deriving the Navier-Stokes equations is much more complicated. So if you get into trouble with Luis, tell him it's my fault that you didn't derive the Navier-Stokes equations. But I'm pretty sure he wanted you to do the simpler thing. So yesterday we introduced the TOV equations. We derived them, I showed you steps on the way to the TOV equations. And so essentially it boils down to two equations that you have to solve plus the equation of state, which I didn't write down here. And what you do here, I'll go back to the presentation. Best to just do this. So it gives you you can parameterize the solutions by the central density, rho, what I call rho c here, and you can calculate the mass of the star, the maximum 2m over r. That's kind of like the compactness factor, how compressed it is, and the radius of the star. So you see that the low density end, there are larger stars, and then once you pass this maximum mass barrier, they become more compact, and they also, as I said before, everything to the right of the maximum mass is unstable. So there are at least one unstable mode that will lead that star to the stable branch. So if you perturb it, it'll either go to the, actually, it'll do one of two things. So it'll go to the stable branch or it'll collapse into a black hole. Okay. And so I drew the mass versus R graph wrong. So in fact, you can slightly see that this seemingly plateau is not a plateau, but it has some slight negative slope. And so the masses are different as you get to further densities. So, and this spiral keeps on going further and further. Okay, so this inset figure is a zoom image of this little spiral here. And what you can do is you can explore critical phenomenon with this system. So you take a neutron star and you perturb it in some way. For my thesis, I won't go into it too much, but for my thesis, I took a scalar field. So it was like a Klein-Gorin field, like what you solved. And it was massless, and it was only coupled through the curvature of spacetime. So what you do is you solve the spherically symmetric Einstein equations, which amounts to just solving for two components of the metric, the GTT and GRR components, and those are just ODEs that you have to solve. So it ends up simplifying the problem quite a bit. And so that's a perfectly valid, general relativistic time-dependent problem, and So you have this minimally coupled scalar field. You perturb the neutron star by collapsing the scalar field onto it, and that then instantaneously compresses the star a little bit because it increases the gravity within the star. And that can then drive the star to oscillate if it's really weak. If the scalar field is really weak, it'll just incite a radial oscillation into the star, and it'll oscillate at the fundamental mode of the star. Or it could compress the star even further and lead to a shock that then rebounds and then ejects some material. Or it can collapse the star all the way to a black hole. Or it can drive the star to the unstable branch. So notice that the unstable branch solutions are more compact. So what the star does is it collapses to the unstable branch, and if you tune that amplitude of the scalar field precisely, you can essentially tune away the unstable mode. And the time at which the solution emulates the unstable solution scales as the log of the distance you are from that critical parameter P star. So if you're right at P star, you can drive this star to the unstable branch forever, essentially. And so this is called type 1 behavior because it's similar to phase transitions in condensed matter physics. So in type 1 behavior, you have a finite transition in mass. So I didn't say that this, but there are one of two. So as I said before about the unstable star, if you're there, it can either lead to a black hole or lead to it can then fall back to the stable branch. And so if you're too high, if the perturbation is too high, then you'll form a black hole. If it's too low, you won't. And at that P star, the black hole mass turns on at a finite value because you collapse to a black hole of mass equal to the star. And then it doesn't change much as you increase P star, if you increase P. And then there's this other behavior, also similar to condensed matter, is that the black hole turns on at infinitesimal mass. So if you drive this, if you keep on turning up the scalar field intensity, and for particularly sparse stars, so stars that start out at smaller central densities, so these are stars kind of out here. If you take those stars and draw and collapse a really powerful scalar field onto them, you can essentially incite this very relativistic self-similar flow onto the center of the star. And again, if you're at P less than P star, you don't get black holes. You just get this focused ingoing shock wave that then, you know, then rebounds. And if you're too high, then you'll collapse part of the star into a black hole. And if you're at P star, you actually supposedly form a naked singularity. So notice that right at P star, mass of the black hole is zero, meaning that there's no black hole. So a black hole is defined as a physical singularity surrounded by an event horizon. But if its mass is zero, then there's no event horizon. Because remember, the event horizon has radius equal to 2m. If m is zero, it has no radius. So it's got essentially it's a bare singularity that you could, if you're really lucky, you could send a photon to, and it could hit that physical singularity, and then you could probe an infinity in the universe, and then all laws of physics break down, and you know, babies cry, anyway, so this phenomenon is particularly interesting because you could form naked singularities in it. And maybe Luis will talk about this next week, and he'll mention, at least last year, they mentioned the bet that my PhD advisor, who discovered this phenomenon of Matt Choptwick, he solved a bet between Kip Thorne, John Preskill, and Stephen Hawking. Hawking thought that you couldn't form these things, and the others thought you could, and so Hawking lost the bet. So, yeah. So anyway, it's really kind of neat stuff. I'll show you a couple movies about it. This is for later. Here. Okay, so here we start with, so the yellow is the unstable neutron star solution, and the blue is the stable solution that I perturb. Okay, and you'll see this little scalar field shoot in from a large distance, come through and just reflect off the inner, reflect off the origin and get, and then it, you know, it goes back out. But the neutron star is unperturbed, and it will, I've tuned it such that it's at P, very close to P star. You can't tune it all the way to P star with a computer because it has finite precision. Okay, so it can only get to round off error. And so it'll look like the yellow curve for a while. It'll oscillate a little bit about it, and then it'll eventually, one, there are actually two solutions, one supercritical black hole forming, one subcritical, which falls back to the stable branch. Okay. So that's the scalar field. So it's tuned such a way that there. So the blue curve, the royal blue curve is the black hole forming case, and this is the non-black hole forming case. And that it's given some kinetic energy, so it doesn't go right back, it doesn't settle down to the stable solution right away. It makes these grand oscillations. If you're closer to the maximum mass, it's easier to drive the solution to the unstable branch, and you can actually get it to emulate the unstable solution for longer. So what I showed you, I'm sorry, was DMDR. So this was what you were plotting yesterday in the tutorial. So it's proportional to the energy density of the solution. So this one is similar to the movie you just saw, but where we're closer to the maximum mass. So you can obviously see here that the stable solution is very similar to the unstable solution. So it doesn't take a lot to drive it to the unstable solution. And the perturbation is even much smaller. I don't even know if you noticed it. So, and since it's not a perfect TOV solution, it doesn't, the perfect TOV solution ends right at the edge of the star. But I have to extend it further out because I don't want to adapt the grid to the radius of the star. So anyway, so it falls out of the unstable solution a few times before it separates into a black hole forming case and not. So. Maybe a little bit more interesting, but less not as easy to interpret. I'm going to show you the velocity of the collapsing neutron star in self-similar coordinates for a near-critical type 2 case. Okay, so it's in self-similar coordinates. The solution is self-similar, so it should look time-independent. Okay, so I'll show you. There will be one graph that is time-independent, and that's the blue curve. It'll settle into a time-independent case and into time independent form, and then the red curve, which is a collapsing neutron star, will tend to that shape. And this is in self-similar coordinates, so what we're really doing is we're continuously zooming into the origin of the solution. So as time goes on, the spatial scale becomes ever smaller. So we had to use adaptive coordinates to add more points to the interior so that we could resolve this ever, you know, these changing spatial and temporal scales. So if looking at this velocity profile, so it reaches a minimum of negative 0.5 c, and it goes all the way to something that's really close to c. Okay, so this is a very, very relativistic flow. Actually, it has Lorentz factors of about 10 to the 5. So, and the sound speed is something also very close to c. And so this is it amounts to a transonic shock, which is not an entropy solution. So it's not an inviscid limit solution of the hydro equations. So the hydro evolution was very problematic, but the reason why it's a physical solution is because we're in a time-dependent non-uniform gravitational potential. So the potential kind of supports this transonic shock. So the material within the sonic radius is collapsing, so it has negative velocity, but then everything exterior is just being squirted out at really relativistic speeds. So those are, the TOV solutions. Any questions? Okay, so we'll be looking at the MHD equations today, and there's, if you know how to solve them, you can explore rich phenomenon that exists in space. There are active galactic nuclei, which are accretion disks around supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies. Most galaxies have supermassive black holes at their centers, and at one point, most of those black holes have been active, meaning that they've accreted enough material that they've become very luminous and possibly eject jets. These jets, for instance, in Cygnus A, these are radio observations, and you can zoom, since they have their radio telescopes or antennae all across the world. You can connect them up and you can create these very large baseline arrays and use interferometry and resolve very fine details on the sky once you do so. And so here they've zoomed in on the center core of the jet, and it's unresolvable essentially. So right in the center there's probably a supermassive black hole powering this really large relativistic jet. And here, this is another active galaxy. You can see kind of something that looks like a disk, and this jet. And these supermassive black hole jets inject entropy into the gas around them. And that entropy then can be essentially used to create stars. Okay, that affects the star birth phenomenon in galaxies. So, in order to understand how galaxies evolve and how stars are born, you also have to understand how jets form space. Okay, so everything is very interconnected in galaxy formation and evolution. And also those stars forming also creates star bursts and stellar winds that then fall back onto the central black hole. So there's this almost complete circuit of behavior. And here in the lower left-hand corner doesn't appear all that great, but this is a stellar mass black hole on the order of 10 solar masses. And it's in our galaxy, and it's very active, and it's called a mini quasar because it's so bright, but it's on a smaller scale, and it shoots out relativistic jets. And this is an observation observed at a period of days, I believe, where they saw a blob of material just kind of split off and separate. And essentially what's going on is you're seeing the front, two blobs emitted, one coming towards you and one going away from you. And if you were to write down, they have a distance estimate. And so they have an estimate for, they could say, okay, then, it goes so many parsecs in a day, that means that it's going at actually like four times the speed of light. So if you do a naive calculation, it looks like the blobs are traveling faster than the speed of light, but in fact it's a time of flight trick that the light approaching, the blob approaching you is communicating to you faster than the light, than the blob receding from you. Also, so in disks, this is what I do. You tend to see this magnetic field behavior. So the bulk of the disk is all turbulent and messy. Looks like a big ensemble of spaghetti. So the green are magnetic field lines. Okay. And the red here is the bulk of the disk. So the color contours here denote the rest mass density of the fluid. Okay, so there's more gas. So red is high, blue is low. The gas is denser in the equator of the disk. And so it's all turbulent in the bulk of the disk. The magnetic fields contribute to the motion of the fluid, and the fluid also contributes to the change in the magnetic field distribution. In the corona, so like the sun has a corona, disks also have a corona where the density is lower, the temperature is higher, and the magnetic fields become more laminar or uniform, okay, less turbulent. In the plunging region, it looks very much like the bulk of the disk, but a little bit more ordered. And in the funnel, the density is very, very low, and you get magnetic fields that are collimated. Here, this is around a spinning black hole, so the magnetic fields kind of get stuck on the horizon, and the horizon just spins up the magnetic field, and so you get this torsion of the magnetic field, and so you have significant radial and azimuth or phi components of the magnetic field. And this is what supposedly launches a jet. You can look at tilted disks. People are doing that. This is a face-on view of the disk using my code, but by a different group. Oops, sorry. Here is a different group looking at the magnetic field lines that form the jet. So you can see how they're somewhat ordered but turbulent in the disk, but in the funnel they get kind of crazy. Not sure why they're so crazy, but in the funnel you can see that they become a little bit more ordered as they kind of dominate the dynamics there, because the density and the pressure are much less than the magnetic field strength there. So these are just some examples of simulations of MHD flows. And so we'll be talking about ideal MHD. So this is MHD that doesn't have any resistivity or viscosity, and the conductivity is infinite. And that amounts to essentially a flux freezing of the magnetic field. Okay, so the fluid elements are once it's on a magnetic field line, it's stuck there. Okay, it can move along that line like it's in a tube. That's what some people usually call them, flux tubes, for that reason. And it can move side to side. So imagine if you have a vertical field here, this fluid element can go up and down. If it's pushed, like through a pressure gradient, it can drag that magnetic field flux tube with it. That flux tube will want to respond back. Okay, and that's because if you write down the Lorentz force equations, you've got some current J cross B, that's the Lorentz force, and because of Ohm's law and the infinite connectivity constraint, J is equal to the curl of B. And so using a vector identity, vector calculus identity, you can write down the force as a gradient of B squared plus a term that it, so this is B dot del operating on B. So it's the divergence of B along B. Okay, so this is a magnetic tension term, and the first term is a pressure term. So B squared, we'll see, acts like a pressure. So as you have more magnetic field, it kind of acts as like as a gas pressure or thermal pressure. And this flux freezing also means that the magnetic field topology is constant in time. So you can tangle up in our disks, you can tangle up the field as much as you want, but if you kind of unravel the disk at a later time, it'll have the same topology as what you started with. And that's assuming that there's no reconnection of the field. But other than that, the topology is preserved. So we typically actually set a kind of a ploidal topology of the field, and it becomes very turbulent, but we know that that topology affects the dynamics in a significant way. So one outstanding problem is, how do you define the topology of the field at t equals zero for a disk that you want to simulate? Because in nature, you've got all these winds coming in, and they have essentially random topologies. And so you really need to know a lot about the object that you're modeling, probably, or maybe not, to simulate these things. Maybe the topology isn't really important to understand the salient aspects of these objects, but maybe it is. That's an outstanding problem in our field. So yes, you had a question.
So does this, did you have like magnetic tension and stuff? Could you like store potential energy into a field by twisting it around or something?
Sure, yeah, definitely. So you could start off with, this is exactly how we do it. We start off with a very weak magnetic field, okay? And it threads the disk like so. So we start off with a disk that looks like this. So this is in the plane. So the black hole is here. This is the R theta plane. Okay, so theta is, or it's the XZ plane. Okay, so we usually start with also a field that goes along these density contours. Okay, so what happens is, so if you zoom in on this little box here, it looks like a vertical field. So let's zoom in on a part that looks like a horizontal field. Okay, so we have this box, there's field going through it. But this part, so we usually start off with a differential flow, so it's like a Keplerian flow. So the inner part is moving at a faster velocity than the outer part. And I think actually I illustrate here. So so you'll get some shear in the flow. That shear will drag the field lines with it, and then that'll build up the magnetic pressure. So this is called shear amplification of the magnetic field, and it'll keep on growing until the magnetic field becomes buoyant or you drive some other instability. So there's this thing called the magnetic rotational instability, where if you have a Keplerian-like flow, where the if the radius here in my diagram, the radius is increasing to the right, and in a Keplerian flow, the velocity orbital velocity increases with decreasing r, but the angular momentum increases with increasing r. Okay, so if you have two fluid elements, illustrated here by the green blobs, connected by a flux tube, it'll want the magnetic tension will put a drag force on the inner fluid element, and will suck some angular momentum from it. So it'll want to go to a lower radius. In addition, that tension will give angular momentum to the outer fluid element, and that fluid element will equilibrize with the surrounding material and will then go to a higher orbit. So you see that then this is a runaway instability because the inner fluid element wants to go to lower radius, the outer fluid element wants to go to a larger radius, but the magnetic tension increases as they become more separate. So this leads to then a runaway instability and then gives rise to angular momentum transport in the disk. So this allows, for instance, you know, you see that the inner fluid element would then accrete to the central object, and then the outer fluid element would, you know, be propelled outward. And it explains the supposed viscosity in disks. So we see accretion happen in nature all the time, but we can't explain the rates of that mass accretion given hydrodynamic viscosity. And so if the gas is ionized and there are significant magnetic fields, then this instability can take over and transport that angular momentum and allow for that accretion to happen. And here, this is a blob of material, and the part on the left is moving into the board, the part on the right is moving out. There's a magnetic field that threads it this way, and you see that the instability takes over and just kind of squirts the right side to the right and the left to the left. Okay. So as that tension increases, you would also have an increase in the magnetic field strength. So that would kind of store the rotational, it's the transfer of the bulk flow of the material into the magnetic field sector. And eventually, the magnetic field in the flow would turn up and be dissipated or reconnect and turned into heat. That heat will then radiate away in light, and then we can see it. So in order to accurately model the emission from objects, we need to understand the plasma dynamics pretty well. There are other instabilities. There's a kinking stability. This is important in jets. I'll just throw it up here. So if the azimuthal component there's a relationship between the azimuthal component and the radial component, and that relationship is violated, then this instability will grow. There's also this Parker instability. So if gravity is down, and you have some oscillation in the field here, the fluid elements, the density, will want to flow down the sides of this hill of the flux tube. And so that will increase the relative strength of the magnetic field to the rest mass density. So the field will become more buoyant, and so it'll even push the magnetic field even higher. So it'll create this tall loop, or tall hill, eventually, which will then probably reconnect away at the base and launch a little blob. So these are just hydrodynamic jet simulations. But these are collapsar jet simulations, so the upper right one you see actually breaks out of the star. So there's actually a pressure and density gradient there. That is the star, and the jet kind of breaks out. So these are gamma ray burst simulations by Zhang and collaborators. So you need a lot of resolution to to simulate these things and adaptive mesh refinement, which Luis will talk about next week. So these are MHD simulations of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which is a hydrodynamic instability where you have two layers of fluid at, I'll start over again. So here you have, he has three, but you have a layer moving at a different, an opposite velocity as the adjacent layer. And this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability then can churn up the fluid. There's a magnetic field in there, so that also then helps incite this turbulence. So this was something like a 1,000 cubed simulation, and this is thought, this kind of setup is thought to occur in GRB GRB jets. So that's why they were simulating this, because the turbulence then allows for the jet to dissipate energy and become luminous, and this is a major component of the afterglow models of GRBs. Okay. So this is, these are the pretty pictures that I was talking about that keep me doing what I do. And now we'll look at the equations that we have to solve in order to do such simulations. And also these are equations that will be useful for your homework assignment.
Mm-hmm. There's something which, like, what kind of numbers in terms of computational power are we talking about when we want to make pretty pictures like that?
Probably most of those simulations required on the order of 100 processors.
Not too big.
Yeah, not terribly big. Yeah, the supernova explosions where they do neutrino transport and they have AMR and they have to resolve all these different scales. Those require, I just talked to a fellow that does this, and he uses this cluster, and he typically uses about 10,000 processors per run. Personally, the maximum I've used is 3,000, and that was just to see if my code could do that. Well, there was one run that I used about 500 to 1,000, so that took almost a million CPU hours of effort. So that's, you know, an hour's worth of CPU's time. So if it ran on one CPU, it would take a million hours. Should be really long, but yeah. So we have to, you know, we have to write a code that allows all these processors to communicate the information to each other. So there are these things called, so the ghost zones, you can set them as physical boundary conditions, but you can also set them as these parallel communication buffers, essentially. So you fill them up, you communicate to the neighbor that needs them for its boundary conditions, and that's how you set up such a code. It's actually easier than you think it would be. So, don't get too impressed by the sophistication of it. Okay, so we'll be looking at the MHD equations. So let's not assume ideal conditions yet. The stress energy tensor. I'll kind of fly through this because we don't have a lot of time, but and the details of the calculation are the point of the your homework assignment. So this is the typical gas stress energy tensor. Plus the Maxwell component. Okay, so this is just the gas stress energy tensor, and then we've added TAB of gas, or hydro, and then this part is TEMAB. It's just the sum of the two stress energy tensors. This is the Faraday tensor. And Ohm's law, the relativistic Ohm's law, looks where J is the space-time current. U, again, is the forward velocity of the fluid. And sigma is the conductivity of the flow. And since it's infinite, then this leads to this condition. So the contraction, so in the fluid frame, the components of the Faraday tensor is zero, and you can actually show that this is equal to the electric field as measured in the local fluid frame, magnetic field. Defined similarly, but with respect to a different tensor. This is the Maxwell tensor, and F star AB is equal to the Levi-Civita symbol, ABCD, FCD times 1/2. Okay, so Maxwell tensor can be written down in terms of the Faraday tensor. And it's essentially just a way of selecting different components of the Faraday tensor. Also note that FAB is anti-symmetric. Are you guys familiar with this notation? Is anyone not? Okay. And similarly, F star parentheses AB is also anti-symmetric. So you could show that then. B dot U is zero. And we've already shown that, and you can also see that E dot U is zero. So these are orthogonal to the flow. Using these relations of the Maxwell and the Faraday tensors with E and B, you can write down the stress energy tensor in terms of these quantities. But we won't be using that equation because E, remember, is zero. So we get the full stress energy tensor to be equal to the hydro part plus B squared plus P plus 1/2 B squared GAB. Oh, I forgot. UA here. Wait, sorry. I'll put it here. Okay, so B squared is just B dot B. And you see that it contributes as a pressure. So B squared over 2 can be, people call that the magnetic pressure. Okay, so it you can actually change your definition of pressure to be P plus B squared over 2, and then you have an extra B squared over 2 here plus this new B. And so you'll see that the magnetic field contributes to the inertia. So this is considered the inertial term, the stress energy tensor. That's what's transported with the fluid flow. That's what's multiplied by the fluid velocities. And then there's this extra component too, the field. So in order to evolve the fluid, you saw these two equations. The stress energy tensor and Maxwell's equations. And also, you know, the continuity equation. And Luis wants you to derive the MHD equations in 3 plus 1 form. So you'll have to project onto these space-like hypersurfaces. So we consider these two hypersurfaces, sigma n and sigma n plus 1. And you know the metric. There's a spatial metric defined on each hypersurface. And we are connected by this normal to the hypersurface. But so this is xi, and this is xi tn. Xi tn plus 1. So the coordinate moves from here to here. But the normal moves from here to here. So the shift tells us how to get back to the coordinate. This is TA. So our projection tensor that allows us to project tensor components onto these spatial space-like hypersurfaces is this HAB tensor. And remember that you should refer back to last week's notes, but NA is equal to minus is alpha 0, 0, 0. But please confirm that before using the equation. I meant to write it down, but I didn't. Now the contravariant term will have shifts here. So here I illustrated n up, but this is n down. So if you're all right, so we use these equations We project the stress energy tensor onto these hypersurfaces to achieve the 3 plus 1 form. And we create, we define auxiliary quantities E, S, and so the energy observed by one of these observers, oops, it doesn't matter, is defined as a contraction of the normal on both components of the stress energy tensor. The momentum observed is a contraction of one component and the projection of the other. So note that HAB is equal to delta AB plus NA up and B down. Okay, so since NB down has only one component, the time component, and it makes this equation much simpler also because of the delta function. So, and then there's this, the spatial component of the of the stress energy tensor is just defined as the projection of both components of the stress energy tensor. And you can find that you these quantities equal to rho plus p plus b squared times w squared minus p plus 1/2 b squared minus NABA squared, where I defined b squared, right? Yeah, b squared w is the Lorentz factor observed by one of these normal observers, normal observers to the hypersurface. BA is also the coordinate velocity projected onto this hypersurface. And where I've defined this projection operator, S can be simplified to look like this, rho plus p plus b squared w squared plus NAB, whoops, note that I'm simplifying the notes a little bit. Oh, and I missed a B here. Sorry. Okay, and remember rho is rho naught times the quantity 1 plus epsilon. Okay, so the next part is just, you essentially just evaluate these equations using those definitions. And these include Christoffel symbols, which you get rid of by the relationship between the Christoffel symbols and the extrinsic curvature. and then you can put them into 3 plus 1 form. So typically what we do is we don't use these small b's and small e's, we use these big b's and big e's. And else. Running over a little bit, but so we define, so instead of with respect to the local fluid velocity, we want to express it with respect to the normal to this base-like hypersurface. So we have to project the Faraday tensor and the Maxwell tensor onto the hypersurfaces. So this is what capital E and capital B are. Note that this is also equal to 1/2 epsilon ABC FBC, where epsilon ABC is equal to ND epsilon NABC. ND, sorry. This is a simpler form.
So do you think this E should be done? So in the expression for the E.
It's consistent. Oh, sorry. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Is that last line on the that board? That's the equality.
And this here, I'm just defining what the perpendicular operator is. And then in order to write everything, so I think you should write everything in terms of these E's and B's. And one way to do that is to translate small b to big B. And do that using this equation. And you can show that also E is eliminated from this problem because you can write it down in terms of big B. And you can also show that big B dot U is equal to small b dot N. So these are little relationships that you can use to simplify the equations. And also one last one. Can show that W squared is equal to 1 over 1 minus VI dot VI. So hopefully you can see why the inversion problem, where we calculate the primitive variables in terms of the conserved variables, it becomes a little bit more complicated when you have multiple dimensions and the B field. And in the notes, it describes a method that you can use to numerically solve the primitive variables, but I won't go into it.
So the real electromagnetic fields are given by small E's and P's or large E's and P's?
The more intuitive fields are the big B's and big B's. Yeah. That's what you typically evolve when you solve these equations. It eliminates the time component for the B. You don't since big B is space-like, there's no time component. So, but at the small B, there is a time component, which you can calculate based upon the spatial components, but it's an extra step. And also because the big B's are closer to our physical intuition, they're what you get in the Newtonian limit, and so people typically use those. Okay. Any more questions?
Okay. There are no questions. So, on behalf of teachers and students at KSI, let me give you this T-shirt.
Oh, wow.
This T-shirt, yes, and wish you all the best in your future research.
Thank you. Thank you.
Teaching and editing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.